Welcome to the 29th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. With us tonight is our lich-like troubadour, Lester Crow, and his strolling bones.
H-E-L-L-O.
Jordan Bloody Sun Boy Steelman.
Howdy.
And Layla Fridge Gargoyle Miranova.
Hi, guys.
And I'm Jesse Gitzman Burke. Let's kick it off with some news. So, not a lot has happened. Unlike our last episode, where pretty much the whole world happened over the last 2 weeks. But there have been still a suspicious lack of news regarding the Heroes Call supplement. I know a lot of people in Europe have still managed to get their hands on it, but rather inconsistently, from what I understand. Somebody finds it in a shop, grabs it, and then there's no more word of it is kind of what I've been hearing. Any other news that you guys have heard on that?
Nope.
I'm definitely silent.
And similar to that, nothing new regarding the Enemy Within, with the one exception that another Warhammer podcast that almost everybody's familiar with, the Small But Vicious podcast, did an interview with Graham Davis. And if you'll recall, Graham Davis is one of the co-writers and authors of the original Enemy Within campaign, in addition to the new one. We talked about him pretty extensively last episode. So I definitely encourage you guys to listen to that. I've listened to about half of it on the way home today, and he does a really nice job of breaking down how the game development cycle worked back in the day, how some of it works now, and the different thought processes behind going into building a role-playing game and the games industry as a whole. So have anybody else had a chance to view that yet?
I have not. This is actually the first time I've heard about it, so I'm going to go have to check that out after we're done here.
Yeah, and thanks to our followers on the Facebook page for bringing that up up front. We posted a link of it on the Facebook page, and we'll put it in the show notes as well. Let's see, other new news. Is that there's two new blogs out there. One not quite so new, but the by Crazy Ido, who is from the Fantasy Flight forums. You there? What day is this? .wordpress.com is a blog he started about role playing mechanics and a little more general topics, and some of it specific to fantasy role play. Third edition, but another blog was also created for a topic that I find particularly hard to communicate to people, which is what's special about Warhammer, or why Warhammer over anything else? How do you get a new player to understand why we like Warhammer? And I find that always to be something really hard to communicate. What do you guys think? Do you guys have that trouble, or does it seem more natural for you?
It's actually pretty natural for me. I thought, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, if someone likes fantasy and they like gritty, dark things, then I would say Warhammer is for them. And I mean, I'm really into the whole flavor or fluff, as they like to call it. So it's pretty easy for me to express the differences between the races and stuff like that. So I would say it's not overly difficult, but I really like that blog. It's great.
So the blog that I'm referring to is explainingtheoldworld.wordpress.com, and what he attempts to do is give a new player perspective or information to someone coming into the old world fresh, maybe from D&D or not having played role-playing games before, and try and give them the basic informational tools to understand what's going on. And I think that's something Warhammer as a whole really lacks.
I don't really see what's special about it.
That was my next question for you. So how do you came into it totally fresh?
Uh-huh.
And I mean, what's your perception, or how do you? You've actually probably read more than most people, but we kind of jumped right into like the source material of third edition.
Yeah. I mean, I was not unfamiliar with fantasy. As a teen or whatever, as a kid, I read a lot. So, but for me, I just kind of accept it for what it is. It's like a means to an end. I want to play. This is the world I'm playing in. So I don't really think it's all that awesome. In fact, I'm not even sure I find it all that interesting, but I find the games, like, with people interesting. The world itself, I don't really care all too much for. Like, I don't know if it's fair to compare it to Game of Thrones, but, like, I find Westeros and just, like, that whole dynamic far more interesting than anything Warhammer-related. But, like I said, I don't know if that's a fair comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might come just from familiarity, too. I mean, mm-hmm. like, if you're familiar with Game of Thrones, and certainly Game of Thrones has hordes and hordes of very, very dedicated fans.
Mm-hmm.
And so people just have, you know, if they're familiar with something, if they're comfortable with something, I dare say that that's really part of the strongest part of D&D's lineage, is that people, you know, it's been around yeah. since the mid-70s, and people are just so familiar with it, they feel so comfortable with it. So
they're also really divided. Yeah. Though by the as far as setting is concerned, I mean, Warhammer has just been a continually produced setting, and I'd say it's much, much, much deeper. There's a much broader variety of information. It's much deeper and engaging setting than even Westeros. I mean, he's written a lot of books, George R. R. Martin, but it's not mm-hmm. even it doesn't even scratch the surface when it comes to how deep Warhammer goes. I mean, it is childish to a degree. I guess it's a miniature war game. That's where all the information originally came from, and it is kind of, I mean, essentially it's just grafting real world things into a fantasy setting, but I mean, it is extremely deep. There's so much to read and know about the world that I can see why it would be daunting for a new person to kind of like
but
really
that,
jump
that,
into
that,
it.
That kind of brings it back to the front on why this blog was created. It's mm-hmm. kind of like, well, how do you get somebody to, I mean, like, I feel like Lester, you, myself, and Jordan, you know, we get that thing that Warhammer does that makes it cool, and we're already sold on it.
I don't get that thing.
Right, and that's okay. It's just, you know, but it brings in that point of, well, we've already been sold on it. How did we get to that point that made us get it? For any other new players out there, why? How does that threshold happen, or is it just something you just have to accept and gradually take in little bits of information until little hooks and connections start getting made?
Well, I'd say different people fall into it for different reasons, though. I mean, it was originally HeroQuest that really got me into the world of Warhammer, and that was originally it. And then it was the miniatures. I was extremely impressed with the paint jobs and the way that those miniatures looked, so it made me want to explore the world more, the combination of the miniatures and
HeroQuest. It was miniatures for me, too.
And then after that, as soon as I started to realize that there was a vast amount of information, I mean, some of the books are terribly written, in my opinion, but some of them are really, really good. And then I always liked the source material for the Battles game. I always thought it was relatively well written and interesting. I mean, it covers all the archetypes of fantasy that I find interesting, like orcs and undead and, you know, the humans against the against everything kind of.
I think it's the particular flavor of fantasy as well, because my experience with coming into Warhammer was not in any way, shape, or form my first experience with fantasy role-playing game settings. You know, I played, like most people, you know, I played D&D primarily, mm-hmm. and I played several other games, and so it was kind of, continued to become more and more experienced in role-playing in general, I kind of understood the things that I liked, the things I didn't like, the things that appealed to me, the things that made me want to explore a game setting, and the things that turned me off. And one of the things that's specific about Warhammer for me versus, say, Dungeons & Dragons is that I've always liked that it's much more down-to-earth, it's much dirtier, it's much uglier, and it's much more about the...
It's almost more
kind
real.
Of, yeah, it's more about the people. It's more about who your character is as a person, as opposed
to flaws.
Right.
People too.
Yeah, living up to or trying to be, you know, the best person you can be, considering that you might not be a very good person. You know, or going and facing off against a horde of undead creatures, but you don't have any magical weapons or super spells or, you know, anything like that. It's really just about your character and their courage and, you know, maybe even their flaws.
Fire.
Yeah.
All you have is fire and pitchfork, kill the zombies, or survive the night.
And the army of zombies is just as likely to, you know, kill you and dump you in a ditch on the side of the road as you are to overcome them. So.
Oh yeah, easily, probably more likely.
I mean, if you guys had to rein in Warhammer, what's special about it to you in one phrase or, you know, a short sentence or two, what is it?
I think it's the tagline that's been with Warhammer for the longest time, a grim world of perilous adventure. To me, interesting role-playing stories are stories that are perilous. If your character, you know, is broken and bleeding and at the threshold of death constantly, then that makes it interesting. If your character is always supremely powerful and can never be challenged, then I get bored really quickly.
Well, yeah, like if Frodo had just had the, you know, a teleporter from Star Trek, and he's just like, oh, I'm in Mount Doom now. Oh, burn the ring. That wouldn't be an interesting story at all. It's the fact that he had
to find it hard not to laugh just hearing the name Frodo.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's kind of a silly guy.
Or if Frodo were like, you know, if he were like an 8-foot tall, muscle-bound, super, you know, Conan wannabe, slaughtered orcs left and right, and he just walked right up to, you know, Mount Doom, then that wouldn't be interesting either, right?
He carried Excalibur.
Yeah, they made a movie about Conan, and it didn't do very well.
New one or the one with the Galvanator?
I don't know if you watched it. I think if I were to kind of sum up what makes it special for me is the very consistent, diametrically opposed concepts that are throughout. You know, it's good versus evil, internal versus external, spiritual versus physical. I find that few of the games capture that essence as good as Warhammer does, or with probably the closest relation I can think of is Call of Cthulhu captures that.
Oh, yeah.
As well. I find that, and we've related Warhammer to Cthulhu many, many times, and we think that it kind of has some of the best elements of it.
Well, they definitely used a lot of H.P. Lovecraft's ideas in creating chaos and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah. I think chaos is probably the most interesting and probably the hardest thing to appreciate in Warhammer.
I would say the Skaven are the most interesting, personally, but I'm just... I was born in 1984, which was the year of the rat, so, yeah.
I like that there's no free rides in Warhammer, that it's very, you know, like we were talking about before, it's just that, you know, whereas in something like D&D, you know, you can cast a fireball all day long, you know, every day, and
at
there's
level
no... it's like, it's just a tool, but in Warhammer, even if you amass power, that power comes with a price, usually a very significant price.
Own you. Oh yeah, you can mutate and become driven.
And so there's no guaranteed road to victory. The most boisterous means are usually the most self-destructive.
Mm-hmm.
I just say it's
modular as well, and that's something I like. I mean, if you do like the flavor of high fantasy, you could play a campaign where you're slaying orcs and riding griffins, and that does happen and does exist in the Warhammer world, but for the average person, it's very grim and gritty and, you know, poverty-stricken, and everybody's diseased and being affected by chaos in all sorts of ways.
Speaking of griffins, Lester, have you seen the new Carl Franz on Deathclaw model?
Yes, and I like how it's modular, too. So you can create Carl Franz, you can create Carl Franz or a general or a wizard, wizard lord on the back, and the wizard lord, the griffin has two heads. And they've been doing that a lot with the models lately. They've been making them modular, so you can create multiple different models out of the kit as opposed to just, you know, getting one model in one kit. It's pretty cool.
There's a whole series of new Imperial models that were released as Advanced Order on the Games Workshop website.
Yeah.
That includes a new Empire hardbound book, which means there's going to be a lot of new source material coming.
Yeah, if you're interested in the source material, I would highly suggest picking up
I'm excited to check that.
Hands on them. Yeah, they're beautiful now. They're so lavish with the whole color.
Lester, you and I are going all over each other today.
Well, I really love this. I'm just used to being you usually run over me, so you know I'm just trying to return the favor.
No, man, you go for it. I was just going to rattle off some of the new models that are coming out, because there's some interesting stuff in here as Games Workshop tries to push some larger models.
Yeah.
They call Franz on Deathclaws exceptionally cool. There's an Empire Celestial Hurricanum, which looks like a celestial wizard's chariot and war machine, kind of like a magic focusing device.
Yeah,
pretty gnarly and cool looking.
Apparently, they use it to launch call comets down from the sky and launch lightning bolts, like mass lightning bolts into ranks of troops and stuff like that. It's cool.
Oh, and they've redone the War Altar of Sigmar, which is pretty neat. That has Volkmar in it, who is the Grand Theogonist, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
It's interesting. They're bringing a lot of the epic named characters back into the Fantasy Battles game who had been taken out for a long time.
Well, wasn't Volkmar killed during the Storm of Chaos? I'm pretty sure he went to face Sirtha Lank or one of those Chaos generals. It might have been Archaon, and he might have tried to fight him, and then he got killed.
But so, most importantly of all the models that are being introduced is the one at the very bottom of the page, the Halfling Hot Pot Catapult is back.
Can you paint that?
Yeah, you can paint that.
I would totally paint that.
Which is three Halfling cooks on the battlefield using their pot of stew as a catapult.
Oh my gosh, that's so cute.
Yeah.
I love the splatters on his little apron.
They've also got those Demigriff Knights.
Yeah,
they announced. I wonder if that is going to be. I wonder if that's going to be a possible mount, or if they're going to even talk about that in the role playing game at all. Because that's very new to the war game.
Yeah,
they didn't really have it before.
I actually felt a little conflicted about those. But what they look like is the Knight's Griffin on effectively. They look like griffins just without wings.
Yeah, they're demigriffs. They are basically giant lion eagle guys with no wings. I don't know how I feel about that either. Probably because, you know, like Jordan said, when you're familiar with something, it's, you kind of stick with it. And I'm not familiar with those in the lore at all. I don't recall them ever talking about Demigriff.
I feel like in this edition of the Warhammer tabletop game, they have been trying hard to create some new stuff.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of new creatures coming out of this edition.
And they're pushing the epicness of it.
Yeah.
Really, they're trying to sell lots of models. But, I mean, as far as the war, like the actual role-playing game is concerned, there are a few models that you could use to quite great effect in the role-playing game if that's what you're into. But that could be a topic for another day, using miniatures in your actual games. But
sure. Well, as we said on the Facebook page and on Twitter, this episode is going to focus primarily on questions and answers that you guys have submitted. You guys have very generously provided us with a wealth of content to discuss. And I think after this break, we're going to hop right into it. As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on Facebook under Reckless Dice, or hit us up on Twitter @RecklessDice. So I'm going to kick off this first question, which isn't really a question, but more a comment that I forgot to discuss in the news, but I wanted to open up to what you guys think. The print-on-demand supplement that came a few weeks ago, the tie-in for Dreadfleet, that introduced a few things that I think we might have kind of skipped over talking about that I think were pretty important. It introduced a few new races that had previously not been touched on in Warhammer 2nd Edition and Warhammer 3rd Edition, which is the Chaos Dwarfs.
Mm, we did talk about that briefly.
Okay, we did. And then the Tomb King. You have a Tomb King kind of like boss creature.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, those are two races that you now have, you can take these characters out of context, out of their captain role, and they make a perfect nemesis creature.
Mm-hmm.
Or a boss creature for any kind of campaign you're running. But the what I found really interesting is the fact that they are legitimately re-including the Chaos Dwarfs back into the setting.
Right.
And they're doing it very subtly still, but I was reading through the Dwarf source book, and in the first couple pages, they make a very direct reference to the existence of the Chaos Dwarves and them living in the Darklands. So they have not been forgotten. They're still subtly alive. No one's really making a lot of content for them still, but the they haven't dropped them off the face of the Earth as kind of what was previously thought of.
Yeah.
Well, they got enough of them called followers.
I was just going to say, I believe that in one of the second edition roleplay books, there was, you know, again, it was just like, you know, a line buried in a book somewhere, but it was some reference to the existence or the rumored existence of the Chaos Dwarves in the Darklands. But yeah, so they've been paid lip service, but that's about all they've gotten for years.
Well, I think that fits the theme, though, a lot, because the majority of the adventuring takes place in the Empire as opposed to out in the Darklands.
Yeah, so everything
were,
outside.
A citizen of the Empire. Well, yeah, if you were a citizen of the Empire trying to discover something about Chaos Dwarves, it'd be relatively difficult to find out, you know.
Yeah. No, or you wouldn't want to delve that deeply into it.
Yeah, exactly.
But we'll kick it off with our first question from Ottoman Scribe via Twitter, and he asks, "What do you think of flashback sequences as a way to get around absent players? For example, flashing back to previous unexplored episodes or events."
I mean, isn't that?
That before. Oh, no problem. Dealing with absent players is actually a really good topic, and there's a lot of different thought from various game masters and their comfort levels. And, you know, are you comfortable, you know, with the game master taking control of a PC, or, you know, letting another player play the PC or whatever? But I think I've done the flashback sessions before, and they work out okay if you find a way to kind of wedge one in there. Sometimes that's a little difficult, though, to kind of find a find something that seems reasonable but still interesting and worthy of playing.
What were you going to say?
I mean, I think they're a great idea. This is kind of what we did with the,
Lore of the Lich Lord?
The Lore of the Lich Lord. It's not so much a flashback as it is kind of like this, I don't know, hovering segment that's sort of, we can make of it what we will, but that's essentially why we decided to do it, because we were missing a player, or our GM, actually. I think it's turning out kind of interestingly, because the further we get into the horror at Hugodol, the more, like, ominous, I suppose, that Lich Lord adventure gets, because suddenly it's adding effects, possibly, that, you know, otherwise wouldn't have even been there. So I think it's a good idea.
For those who haven't listened to those episodes, the Chris Wagner, who's GMing the Horror at Hugodol episodes, we had some scheduling conflicts, but we all still wanted to play. So it's kind of like this, you know, flashback sequences instead of this, like a flash sideways or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's,
And we were like, well, we still want to play, but we don't want to roll up all new characters. Let's just use what we have, but how do we make that not affect our existing game? And so we came up with this, like, dream sequence or, you know, something not unlike a flashback. And, you know, maybe or maybe not, there was ramifications of what happened in that flash sideways to the games you're playing.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, the only, like, concern with that I could see somebody having would be, well, how did my character have these abilities if we're flashing back to, you know, a year previous?
Well, we had debated...
Other than that, then...
We had debated when trying to decide how to play the Lore of the Lich Lord game, how to handle this, because we were like, well, we could take all of our existing characters and just pretend it happened before Hugodol, but then they're like, well, yeah, but I have all these wounds, and I have this disease, and I've already leveled up a few times. You're like, okay, well, maybe it just takes place afterwards. Well, what if one of us dies? And it's well, none of those scenarios work. I think it really will depend on the level of detail that the GM feels he needs to maintain over the game.
And that the players
if you have a flexible group.
Yeah.
Yeah, a flexible group, I think, can accommodate things like that much easier, and I think it lends itself to being really exciting and fun, because you can plant new plot threads. You can, I almost picture, like, you're playing some of these games like an episode of Lost, where, like, you're playing it, but then, wait, what just happened before? Let's bring something new in. And, you know, you can have some fun with it if you're willing not to be so controlling. But some people just don't like doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, and some GMs and some players are willing to kind of, you know, let it go and suspend the disbelief, and some are a bit more, you know, bit more clenched about all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess ultimately it'll work for some people and not for others.
Yeah, I think you know, like any good thing or like any good group decision, you should consult your players and ask them how they would feel about doing something like that. And it, you know, like in your Lure of the Lich Lord, it doesn't even necessarily have to be explicit that this is in the past or this is in the future. You know, you can just kind of play it and then decide later on exactly how it fits into the events of your game.
That's funny you say that, Jordan, because that you know, from I'll be pretty open with this concept because I really haven't fully thought it through yet. It was really just an excuse to play that scenario or at least get it started because it's one of my favorites. I have no idea what I'm doing with it yet. The dream sequence idea was the only one that seemed to logically fit, but mm-hmm. in my head I've been toying with ideas on how to tie it in the future when we ultimately end that adventure. I mean, the way I set it up now is at any point in time through a dream sequence, we can revisit that adventure and continue it, and maybe it'll continue to haunt them in their dreams until they've ultimately resolved what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someday in the future they might realize that all that was real life anyway, and they just didn't, or taking over someone else's bodies, or, you know, who knows what. It could be pretty creative, I think, still.
I don't. I'm looking at our Twitter page, and somebody actually tweeted at us, Automanscribe. He says, using flashbacks to get around absent players has led to our campaign being something like Memento.
Uh-huh. and then he says, not a bad thing.
Yeah.
That's actually really cool. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Ottoman Scribe has got our next question here, which we're going to jump into now, also via Twitter. Do you think it's better to give players a base of operations or to force them to wander the world?
I think that's an interesting question.
What do you think?
I'm not sure I have a preference. In fact, I didn't really think about it until I read that question, but now that I'm starting to think about it.
Because we played a couple different styles of games up to this point.
Yeah.
With bases of operations and without. Do you think either of them worked better than others, or...
Which one had bases of operation that we played?
Well, I kind of feel like Michael's game, The Buried But Not Forgotten, has the main town as our base, but we can free pretty roamly from it.
Mm-hmm.
The Witch's Song had every town kind of acts, or an inn tends to act as a base of operation.
Oh,
as opposed to an adventure where somebody maybe is going from location to location, like just slaying beasts and moving along on the road the whole time.
Oh. I think that kind of appeals to me, the wandering part, but I guess I read the question a little differently because I don't know how you would do that then. Because ultimately, don't you have to go back to town to complete your mission? So ultimately, you have to have a base of operations?
Mm-hmm. I think you'd have to formulate a story that kept you moving from place to place, like if you were tracking somebody down from town to town,
mm-hmm.
as your mission,
yeah.
Your home base mm-hmm. effectively gets eliminated.
I guess I read it as like each character has a base of operations, so ultimately that character has a goal of like getting back home versus just characters wandering freely around the world without any home.
Hmm.
And I think like Jesse said, it has to do with the motivations of the campaign in general. Because, I mean, if the goal is to send them to all sorts of parts of the world, then they don't... Well, I mean, even then, you could have a base of operations, you know? Like, Altdorf could be your base of operations, and then you're just...
Yeah, but I think it's more like
place
how...
to place, but...
From a, I mean, you could have a base of operations that you visit once a month. That to me, doesn't mm-hmm. really feel like a base of operations. I think in the context of an adventure... Is there some place you return to every day?
So could that
to
be like
turn in your quests and get new quests, or to buy your equipment?
Could that be like could that be the inn where you go and you sit and reform?
I think
an
inn certainly feels
rest.
Like loosely constructed base of operations. But is there, you know, at some adventures, especially later on, you know, your characters might own property. Mm-hmm. At which point,
way later
base
on,
operations.
In my games.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that doesn't really happen in many of mine, but the
at rank two, you don't own property,
right.
Unless you were born a noble. You know, like yeah. If you chose to be a noble character, you probably have access to some sort of base of operations that comes with the character type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Mark Rumble makes a post on the Reckless Dice Wall, which is a little bit less of a question and more of a comment worthy of a bit of discussion. He says, something I love about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and also hate at the same time. He loves all the chits, cards, and dice because they give players an amazing visual aid to gameplay. The cards are a stroke of genius because it's easy reference for all the unique attack spells that the PCs have at their disposal. At the same time, he hates it as a GM because there's too many chits, cards, and dice, and he can't seem to get it organized. Most games, he uses two GM screens to keep players' noses out of his business. Keep up the good work with the podcast.
Oh, man, I disagree, but agree at the same time, so I'm kind of in the same boat.
That's his question, sir.
So like, you're saying you love but hate it also.
Yeah,
exactly. It took me a long time to figure out a way that I was comfortable with organizing it, and it's probably only at about 80% or 85% organized, but, I mean, I have all the cards put into Ultra Pro sleeves in binders that look like ancient tomes, and I've organized it pretty well. I've got a bunch of velvet bags, and everything's really well organized. I mean, I should make a video about it to show you how I did it. It takes a lot of effort. You have to have the organizational skills of a military quartermaster, but once you get it organized, it doesn't seem like there's too much stuff. I mean, the benefits outweigh the deficiencies or the problems, in my opinion.
Now, I have to say that I can feel Mark's pain, and I'm going to be completely and bluntly honest. I do not use 100% of the components that come with the game.
Me neither, definitely not.
Yeah, well, I it was kind of an exploration with this game that, you know, when I first got it, and then I tried to absorb everything about it, and then I tried to play it, and as I played it, I just kind of learned the elements that I liked, that I felt were the most, you know, inspirational and the most useful, that were the most efficient, you know, use of the table space, because table space in my game is, you know, players want to have their snacks and their drinks and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and so there's just not room
for side tables, man. Side tables. You got to get a little fold out side. That's what I got.
but I found that once I really dug down into the game and once I really analyzed it, I did find the components that I felt were interesting, but that they weren't necessarily seeing as much use, or they weren't really they were really there kind of to look pretty, but they really didn't do anything, or at least didn't do what I was hoping that they would do. And some of them, basically, I'm a minimalist, generally speaking. So I cut a number of things out of my game, but I think I've gotten to a point where, like Lester says, it takes organization. I'm a bit OCD about how I organize those components, but it's much that Mark OCD. Hits a...
Every single GM I know is not like an OCD issue.
Yeah, well, that's part of being a GM. I mean,
well, so from Jordan, Lester, and myself are all coming from the perspective of a GM. And recently, as I've been playing with Michael and Chris Wagner, I've had the opportunity to experience Warhammer 3rd Edition from a player perspective. So I've had the opportunity to kind of see the organizational elements from both sides. Layla, how do you feel as a player with components and how much stuff is going on the table?
I definitely think that the game requires a lot of table space, because definitely there are a lot of cards, and I cannot keep track of, like, half of them. And I feel like it's overkill in a lot of ways. Then again, if you're able to utilize the cards, like, I think Michael...
Wilson.
Yeah, Michael Wilson. I think he does a great job of organizing all of the cards for us. Like, he's got labels, he's got little boxes. I mean, if we're talking OCD, like...
He does an amazing job.
He's got it. But he does an amazing job of, like, keeping everything straight. So, you know, I guess I both like it and hate it, too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward at some point soon to trying another role-playing game with you where you... don't use all the components, mm-hmm. and hearing kind of the back and forth of how much rules looking up happens and the flow of the game and how much immersion there is without as much tangible elements.
Mm-hmm.
Just introduce you to D&D next. It'll be the
D&D probably new. Won't happen, but Call of Cthulhu is where I'd like to.
Yeah, that would be a great game.
That's something I'd really like somebody else to GM, though. That's one that I love, but have a terrible time actually running. I can't
I just have a terrible time finding somebody else who is willing and wants to run, or willing and able to run other campaigns.
I find Cthulhu games require a very experienced GM to run smoothly and effectively, and that's hard to come by.
Yeah.
Role-playing games in general, if you are a GM and you go in to play a game with somebody else, I find that it's almost required for me, at least, that the GM be relatively well-versed in GMing, or it becomes difficult. I mean, maybe that's just my own problem that I can't get over if somebody makes a mistake when I'm a play. I don't tell them what to do, but my enjoyment of the experience is definitely lessened if they provide a play experience that I'm not, like, blown away by. I mean, I've had the opportunity, especially younger, to play with people who are excellent GMs, and, you know, maybe I'm spoiled or whatever, but I have a hard time finding people who want to GM, let alone have the capability of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find conventions to be some of the best places to find people who are very openly willing to...
Yeah, but I live in Canada, and there are, like, one convention a year here. Like, it's not like the States.
Yeah. Well, we'll fly you down sometime soon.
Oh, well, we'll just fly down.
When all our huge money hat paychecks come in from Fantasy Flight.
Oh, and Fantasy Flight finally recognizes the fact that we are a huge support system for their games. Yeah. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, they don't even talk to their own customer base very often.
All right. Will Skates Francis also comments on the Reckless Dice podcast wall. I somehow forgot the whole toughness and soak thing in my first game, despite having listened to the podcast where a similar mistake was made. As Michael says, it is only really an issue if people weren't having fun or making the game unplayable. So what he's referring to here is, some of his players or some of his creatures were taking damage, and he forgot to mitigate it by both the soak added to the toughness, which is what I forgot to do as a GM for the first, I think, two sessions when we were playing A Day Late, A Shilling Short. So it's kind of funny that that's something multiple new GMs are experiencing. But he brings up a very interesting point, which is that if nobody notices, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So as a GM, that's really good advice. Don't get hung up on messing up a rule. If you've already messed it up, just roll with it and fix it next time.
Especially if the game's flowing. Don't kill the flow of a game just because you feel you're using the rules incorrectly.
Oh, yeah.
One of my biggest pet peeves is stopping the game to look up a rule.
Yes.
That should be done, in my opinion, during breaks, before games, after games. If you can come up on the fly with a suitable rule that you're comfortable with that could take its place if you've forgotten something, go with that.
Yeah, well, that's why this game's so great for its modularity, for the rally steps, for the fact that the majority of the rules are written on cards, and for the community support. There's lots of really good PDFs that have all the rules condensed into a manageable form. And but I give that, you know, I think this community is great, personally.
So let's jump on to Aaron Mokhtar, our resident Klingon, also commented on the Reckless Dice Facebook page. He gave us a handful of short questions, and I'm going to hand these out to you guys one at a time. He'd like to know or hear discussion on the many ways of initiating or planning an ambush or a surprise attack. Now, I'm assuming he's taking this from a GM's perspective of how do I design an ambush for players to encounter?
Mm-hmm. Tons of ways.
So the players are the ones ambushing, or the players are the ones being ambushed?
I'm guessing he's thinking, because I know he does a lot of GMing. I'm assuming he's saying, how do I design a ambush that my players are
against the players? Yeah, I would say you need to.
Well, I guess we can approach it both ways.
Well, you should detail, if you're the game master, you should detail the location and the enemies who are ambushing the players. You should kind of have their motivations and goals. You should know how they're going to utilize the terrain and anything around them to their advantage. They should have a plan of attack and a plan of retreat if things don't go the right way. And then, really, you got to give your players an opportunity to overcome the surprise through observation checks or things.
You know what I'm hearing as you describe all that is a perfect use for the new dice mechanic where you kind of combine a dice pool and build one through a series of, you know, events that you through your planning and whatnot. So maybe this is a scenario where the bad guys are making this plan. So if the bad guys have set up an ambush, begin adding characteristic dice, fortune dice, and misfortune dice based on the effectiveness and the planning that went into the ambush. You know, you have a certain number of people who are participating in it, and then you're adding misfortune dice and challenge dice based on the number of PCs and what they're trained in for observing. You could you do almost the opposite, I guess.
Yeah, you could.
Really do.
The way I would do it, though, is I just basically have it so that the players are going to, at one point, run into the surprise attack or ambush, depending on how the story's going. And at the point that, you know, before the encounter happens, you just make your players, maybe the player with the best observation skill using the assistance of other players who are paying attention to the situation, rolls an observation check. And if they observe their enemies, then they are not surprised. Other than that, they are surprised.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately an ambush will always come to one critical point where when either the people walking into the ambush discover it ahead of time and have the opportunity to ambush the ambushers, or the ambush is sprung successfully and the people being ambushed are caught off by surprise. And that is resolved through some kind of observation check by the people being ambushed.
Yeah.
And
or stealth check or whatever. But I mean, I think that because the mechanics, the dice mechanics in this game, you want to try to lessen the amount of dice, like checks being rolled. So I would just, you know, set a difficulty level for my players to notice the ambush ahead of time and then have them roll it. Maybe for every challenge dice, everybody who's just assisting the main observer is considered not aware of it and they don't get to act in the first round or whatever. But, I mean, I think the main thing is knowing what the ambush is attempting to accomplish and how the ambushers are going to go about, you know, putting their goals into place. Like, how are they going to ambush them successfully? Why are they there? How are they going to utilize the surroundings to their advantage?
I think it was episode 2, near the end of episode 2 of Buried But Not Forgotten, we had an ambush encounter with Michael Wilson, which was played out with some goblins on a road. That's a really good example of how to handle and execute an ambush and how to surprise players, but also make them feel like they're in control. So I'd encourage anybody who's curious on how to handle an ambush to check that out. Aaron's second question is there a formula for setting up creatures versus NPCs? And what I'm guessing he's getting at here is
PCs.
How many creatures do I send against my PCs in any given encounter?
The idea of encounter balance. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm gonna be a little outspoken here and say that like with anything in role playing games, there's always different points of view on it, and I'm not trying to, by giving my point of view, I'm not trying to invalidate anyone else's. But I am absolutely opposed to the idea of specific encounter balance. Because I believe that encounters should happen, I'm going to use the word organically.
I agree.
Encounters happen when they happen as dictated by the needs of the story, and they happen with the people who happen to be at that particular location at that particular time. So if you come across, you know, 5 orcs and you decide that your players want to be, you know, butts and they want to pick a fight with them, well, guess what? You're going to fight 5 orcs whether or not 5 orcs is a balanced encounter for you.
You know, a good example of that is in our recent Buried But Not Forgotten game, we decided to raid minor spoilers, but this is several episodes back now, so I feel it's reasonably safe. We decided to raid a goblin camp, and we know well ahead of time that there are 30 or 40 some odd goblins in there, and we do our best to make the best of that situation. I won't get any more details because it's a significant part of the story, but that was a great example of it was by no means a fair fight against us, and we still chose to take on that challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the risk of making that decision,
Made it all the more exciting.
Yeah.
There's a very important element for me in role-playing games is, as a player, but especially as a GM, is the creation of tension. Tension needs to exist, and tension is basically just a way of saying that you have to recognize that every decision has a risk, and you have to evaluate whether the risk is worth, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. So if you feel
you have to give freedom of choice to your players as well.
Yeah, and the players can certainly, you know, I use kind of a cute, colorful term, but I always tell my players, you know, if you go mucking around in Troll Swamp, don't be upset if a troll decides to make you his dinner. I will give you fair warning that you're mucking around in Troll Swamp, but if you can decide, I'm not going to tell you you can't do that, but if you decide to do so, just know that it's called Troll Swamp for a reason.
One of my favorite things, especially for early players, is because early players tend to be a little more reckless with their characters because they don't know their limits, and it's a lot of fun to have a new player just get their butts kicked by something because they bit off a little bit more than they could chew, and then watch them the next time they try and do something to be a little more cautious and begin testing waters to see really what is safe and what's not. And it makes those future decisions after surviving a dangerous encounter all the more exciting.
Yeah. No, just on a quick aside, how do you feel about, like, Jordan, you were saying you are opposed to the idea of encounter balance. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about party balance? Do you think that the player characters should be balanced, or do you think that, like, a rank 2 character, somebody who's been playing with you for a long time, should have the right to be better than someone who just joins you?
Well, ultimately, when it comes to the PCs and when it comes to the players and when it comes to the group and the player characters, I really am wanting to act in the best interest of a good time. You know, we're all there. Mm-hmm. We're spending our Saturday night or whatever to enjoy each other's company and to have fun telling a story. And so really that takes precedence for me. So I try to make sure that everyone's being treated fairly. But at the same time, I don't do a whole lot of, you know, hoopla and howdy-do about making sure that every character, you know, it's like this character has 30 points, so this other character absolutely has to have 30 points. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, then they can whine and cry and say, well, my character only has 28 points, and that's not fair. Well, you know, so, well, and Warhammer is really interesting, too, because even in the group, say, PCs that I have in my game, I have one character who is a pit fighter slash shield breaker or a iron breaker. And so he is all about combat, and he will run people up and down, and he chops people in half left and right, whereas I have another player character who has the same number of experience points, but he's playing an apothecary. He has no combat skills, he wears no armor, and so the idea that these characters have to somehow be balanced with each other just doesn't really work for me, because they're really just specialists. Like, a person should specialize in something, you know, whatever it is that their character would naturally be good at. So when you know, the orcs attack, the dwarf is on the front lines, but you bet that the apothecary is running for the cover of the jungle.
Yeah, going to look for mushrooms to make his next potion.
Yeah, or you know, just diving into a ditch and trying to keep out of the line of fire of arrows.
That's pretty much all my apothecary does.
But when it's
I just feel like that's normal.
You're playing your person to actually survive, unlike some people who are compelled to fight.
I guess, but if I have no armor, like, why in the world would I fight?
Oh, I'm not saying you're doing it wrong. I'm just saying,
I'm the healer.
It's the built-in
peace, not war.
It's role-playing. You're playing your role accurately.
I'm going to just jump down just the list a bit here. I'm going to jump down the list of it. We've got a lot of backlogged questions, which I'd love to talk about, but they're not necessarily time sensitive. So we're going to talk about those on a later episode. What I want to do is touch on a few of the most recent ones that came in today as we were getting ready for this episode. Most importantly, we have the proper definition for Banana and Prinsip, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that absolutely 100% correct.
I mean...
But this is from Zwobot, who he says, "Great episode. Thanks for pronouncing my name right. Lester did understand my analogy right. The Banana Prinsip is a German metaphor meaning a sarcastic phrase which demonstrates the hope that a still verdant or incomplete product ripens at the consumer's desk. In my opinion, the adventures Edge of Night and The Gathering Storm were not ready to play products. Edge of Night is bulky without fun and motivation for the players, with a too old twist at the end. It is a good source book for Ubersreich, but not much else. The Gathering Storm are three nice episodes with horrible interludes and a much worse finale. Both adventures cannot be played right out of the box. They need a lot of work. All the other adventures were nice to play without too much work. Power of Thanes is the only one he has not played yet. The rest ran smoothly and had lots of fun." I feel better off knowing what Banana and Prinsip means. That's just a lot of fun to say.
I mean, you've been using it in just regular speech now.
At least once a day now.
I am.
I mean, I've been pronouncing it wrong every time. It comes out differently every time I say it. But do you guys still? I know we talked a bit about the those adventures in last episode and how they were a little. You had to kind of tweak them a bit to suit your play style. Do you guys still feel that's the case?
I just feel that that's what any pre-made, like any game master should take a pre-made adventure and tailor it to fit their party and their play style and their game mastering style. You should never take it right out of the box and play it right out of the box.
Yeah.
I mean, you should make your own adventures if you want to do it that way.
But you can't expect the writers and designers of a module to anticipate your player characters, you know, and your players more specifically, because players...
Yeah. Or players, the way you game master...
Yeah, exactly. You know, what your goals are, what the themes you like are, what kinds of encounters you like to run, you know, the way your players will react to certain things. Because, you know, they just can't anticipate, you know, a million players playing the same adventure and trying to figure out how they'll all react.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. I think, now, there's certainly maybe some adventures that are written in a way that they are more generic, or at least they can be used more.
But I'll bet that there's always at least one thing that you'll change out of it.
Oh yeah, I don't think I've ever run a module without making some degree of changes to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that everything's Banana and Prinsip then when it comes to pre-made adventures. If you want an adventure that completely is tailored to your playstyle and your party, just make an adventure yourself. Yeah. It's really not that difficult.
Yeah. I mean, even the incredible the original Enemy Within campaign that I'm running, mm-hmm. you know, I'm running the campaign materials, but even from the very first adventure, you know, there were things, I was reading through it, and I knew my player characters ahead of time, which is the way I like to do it. I actually like to know my player characters, you know, what they're going to be before I run the campaign, so that way I can kind of tailor it to those player characters. And so, yeah, even it's a great campaign, but even that campaign has had some changes, and I've dropped some NPCs, and I've added some NPCs, and I've changed some encounters, just because, you know, it just needs to fit the players.
Well, we're going to do two more questions and then wrap it up for this episode. We have another one here from Aaron Mokhtar, who posted on the Facebook wall. He was wondering, when you can only get a group together once a month, do you play the session like normal or at the pace that your players are playing and just pick up where you left off? Or do you speed up time between sessions so that even though you're not getting much game time in, the story moves on faster? I think you could reword that slightly to be, do you play your game, do you compress and move time and the events along quickly during the times you do play so you can actually complete stories in a timely manner? Or do you just play at the pace that your players play at?
I think once again this comes down to play style. If your players want to be immersed and want to experience every corner and every twist and every turn, then you might want to you know, go about doing things in a, not shortening time, but, you know, making everything have impact. And then if you want to speed it up, if your players don't mind and they want to get from point A to point B as fast as possible, then I'd probably suggest, you know, speeding it up.
I couldn't agree more. I think this kind of, to me, feels like the one of the big differences between how Michael Wilson likes to play or GM and how I like to GM. I think Michael likes to play it at whatever pace we're moving at and has no problem if we spend six sessions running around in the forest.
And you're fast and loose.
And mine, I feel like I'm running. I feel like I want to run a TV show.
Yeah, you're like the Runaways, man.
There's a set amount of time that we are able to play, and I am trying to run the adventures kind of by the book as best I can and keep them in a somewhat rapid momentum in order to keep them entertaining as an audio show.
Right.
So I think
there's that medium too, because you're not just I mean in a sense, you know, maybe you're just there with the players or whatever, but you're also having to accommodate for the fact that you do have an audience and you have to be sensitive to the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the primary drivers in the way that I run the games that I GM.
Oh, which is not to say that Michael's are any less entertaining. I mean,
oh, they're fantastic. Yeah. But yeah. I think he has a series of experienced players who can feed off of him, and he feeds off of us well to the point where everybody's dialogue is, I think, priceless. I mean, I laugh. I listened to about an hour of it today at work, and it was so much fun. It's just, I was laughing all over again at everything that we did.
The buried but not forgotten ones?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So those are excellent.
Yeah. There's a lot of shenaniganizing going on in those.
Absolutely.
It's always the best part.
I would like to give my props out to Dustin, who plays Lars, who is just a constant source of laughs and amazing facial expressions, which just don't translate into the audio, and I wish they would.
Take some pictures.
Some of them might. We even said it in the podcast for like, you know, oh my god, I really wish we just had the video of this because what you just did there was amazing. So we'll do. Well, maybe two, because this one right here really isn't a question. This is a call out from Daniel Weiss, who asked if Michael Wilson would provide a table or a list of the traveling details that he outlined in our most recent adventure, episode 5. He came up with a nice card and talked about in quite a bit of detail a pretty neat mechanic for handling a group traveling either through a forest or on a road with lookouts and different people having different roles and what kind of attributes would be applicable there. So I know he listens to the show, so hopefully he'll hear this and maybe find some time to post that on the Fantasy Flight forums or something like that, because he did an excellent job there. Let's see. Our last question will be from, how about Cephal Adieu? And I say that with
Did you pick that because it would be difficult to say?
I mean, I picked it because it was colored
we
orange.
We haven't had trouble with names all episode.
I'm going to pretend that's French. And that comes in on our Twitter account and says, do any of your podcasts feature how to level characters, spend advances, or change careers?
Yes.
Well, have we really gotten into details actually on the audio to do some of that yet? I have a feeling we might have.
I do recall us talking about it for a part of a session when Paul was still,
maybe early on. I think we're high time since we have a really nice and concise character creation episode. I think it's time that we do a feature on transitioning your characters out of a career, spending those advances, what's entailed in transitioning careers.
Well, we could do two parts and talk about the characters and how a game master can, you know, change his creatures too. That could be a really good episode.
Yeah, let's maybe focus on. So we're not going to do that in this episode. We will table that one as an actual topic for perhaps our next episode or one very soon.
I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand how to do it. I mean, I would be one of those people. I mean, that is the most confusing element of the game for me.
It is a little bit tough. Michael Wilson did a great job walking us through it. I feel I have a reasonable grasp on how to do it, but I have to grab the books and walk through it as I do it.
Yeah, like, I think I understand it, but that's not good enough for me.
Well, stay tuned then for that one.
I was hoping somebody would say stay tuned.
So that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Be sure to comment on the site, recklessdice.com, or shoot us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at Reckless Dice. Till next time, guys, thanks for listening.